is the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, a gruesome find as hundreds of horse carcasses found in a property near Wagga Wagga. We find out how and why this happened. And Barnaby Joyce says the decision on the APV staying in Armidale is not real decentralisation if most of the senior staff are mostly based in Canberra. He thinks it's a bit of a sort of stay of execution.
Yeah, they had a review, but I know how this game works. You ask for reviews, you already know your answer before you ask for the reviewer to review, to endorse your answer, to give it some legitimacy. And really, the source of this review is people in Canberra got terribly upset that we had the temerity to ask for a very small sense of decentralisation out of Canberra. And, of course, that doesn't suit the public servant union.
We'll have more on that decision to keep the APV BMA in Armidale. But, of course, senior staff don't have to stay there. Most of them will be based in Canberra. We'll get some reaction to that news shortly. But first up, it's been a big week for the Senate inquiry into supermarket prices, with Bunnings, Coles and Woolworths all copping a bit of a grilling. And there were plenty of fiery moments too, such as this one from Green Senator Nick McKim.
You're here before a Senate committee today. We're not interested in PR spin. We're not interested in you kind of bullshitting your way through this committee. We are interested in you answering the questions.
But beyond the bluster, will this inquiry actually achieve anything? Well, Matt Brand spoke to Jolyon Burnett from the National Farmers Federation and asked for his thoughts on what has been learnt this week.
I think we've learnt that the consumers and the suppliers' concerns are well-founded. I think to see representatives of the three big boxes duck and weave and evade really has confirmed in everyone's mind that they're participating in behaviour towards their suppliers and their customers that they're not particularly proud of.
Do you think this inquiry will actually achieve anything and lead to anything meaningful?
It is something that certainly concerns the members of the Horticulture Council. This wouldn't be the first public inquiry where there's been a lot of sound and fury, but it's ended up signifying very little. So we are concerned. But look, I think it's worth saying that the level of public scrutiny on the big boxes, on the supermarkets, I think there are six separate inquiries of various kinds looking into this. And the interest the public has shown and the airing that it's got in the media, I think will mean that CEOs and their boards think a lot more carefully before participating in this sort of unconscionable behaviour and before, you know, they so blatantly attempt to price gouge. So I do think it will see a tempering of behaviour at the very least. Now, obviously, we hope for far more than that. We hope that...
Yeah, what would the National Farmers Federation ideally like to see?
Yeah, we'd like to see... There's a thing called the Food and Grocery Code, which is at the moment voluntary, but it sort of stipulates the sort of behaviour there should be between suppliers to these big supermarkets and Bunnings and those companies. At the moment, it's voluntary. We would like to see it made mandatory, and we were very pleased to see Dr. Emerson's interim report recommend that. We'd like to see the ACCC given much increased investigative powers to be able to demand information from the big supermarkets and Bunnings, to be able to determine clearly whether they are price gouging, what sort of margins they are charging. You know, one of the hidden costs here is they may at a headline level, pay growers market price for their produce. But then by the time the growers paid the rebate for promotion, the rebate for shelf space, the rebate for store improvements, the rebate for early payment, growers are often getting much less than the original contract price. So we'd like to see the ACCC have powers to expose those kinds of behaviours and the details of the contracts, not necessarily to the public. We understand commercial sensitivities, but at least so that they can be assured this sort of behaviour is not taking place. We'd like to see much increased penalties. And again, we were very pleased to see Dr. Emerson recommend in his interim report penalties of up to 10% of turnover. Now, you know, God forbid that those sorts of penalties ever need to be used, but it is really important that the regulators have those sorts of penalties that are commercially significant to companies of this size in their back pocket to try and to improve their behaviour.
So, just on the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct, I heard Bunnings argue that the code's sort of designed for supermarkets and is not fit for purpose for a retailer like Bunnings. What do you think?
Oh, look, we think it should undoubtedly be applied to Bunnings. We do accept that there may be some modifications, some alterations required. Yeah, I would accept Bunnings' point that there are some differences, but not sufficient to warrant not including them in the code. Their behaviour is so similar to the behaviour of Coles and Woolworths that it's very clear they need to be regulated under a similar framework.
And just finally, I think we've all learned a bit about return on equity in the last 24 hours or so. Do you think it's an accepted measure of a company's profitability?
Oh, look, absolutely. I mean, I acknowledge that Woolworths' board and their shareholders are entitled to use whatever measure of their profitability they see fit. However, they would be calculating their return on equity, and clearly Coles' ability to give that figure to the inquiry shows that the companies do measure that. And it's also a legitimate measure of profitability. And Woolworths' reluctance to divulge it, I think Senator McKim and the inquiry were right to be suspicious of that. You know, when their return on equity makes them more profitable than the most profitable banks in the world, while consumers and growers are having to tighten their belt, I think that really tells the whole story.
Thanks for your time today.
No problems, Matt. Thanks for your interest.
That's the chair of the NFF's Horticulture Council, Jolyon Burnett. It's 13 minutes past 12.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
We were talking about this yesterday. The headquarters of the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority in Armidale, well, it's safe for now, with the federal government yesterday confirming it will remain in the city, despite a review recommending it be moved back to Canberra. But the decision comes with a catch. There's now no stipulation for APVMA employees to be solely based in Armidale, and they can work from Canberra instead. Yesterday's announcement was a result of a evaluation of the authority by former public servant Ken Matthews that had been handed to the government. In his findings, Mr. Matthews also attributed the decision of former Agriculture Minister Barnaby Joyce to decentralise the authority as a factor in some of the problems the organisation has faced in recent times. Member for New England Barnaby Joyce responded to some of those issues when he spoke to Christy Reading.
Well, it's a typical sneaky swindling language that you get from people who think you're so naive that you're going to swallow what they say when you don't actually look at the details. And we do look at the details, Minister Watt, and we do look at the details, Mr. Matthews. Now, yeah, they had a review, but I know how this game works. You ask for reviews, you already know your answer before you ask for the reviewer to review, to endorse your answer, to give it some legitimacy. And really, the source of this review is people in Canberra got terribly upset that we had the temerity to ask for a very small sense of decentralisation out of Canberra. And, of course, that doesn't suit the public servants union.
the Commonwealth Public Service Union, and it doesn't suit the sort of zeitgeist of Canberra, who believes that everything to do with taxpayers' dollars should be spent there. Now, what we've got is that it said the headquarters will remain in Armidale. However, the people who run the headquarters don't have to. And last year, out of the 14 executive decisions, 14, 13 were in Canberra. And, of course, that doesn't go too well for Armidale. They've got a new CEO starting. Do they have to live in Canberra, live in Armidale? No, they don't. Are the vast majority of new employees being employed in Armidale or Canberra? Well, the answer to that is Canberra. But they come up here and say, oh, look, we're looking after you and we're going to help you. So their help goes on the back of the Inland Rail, which they've kicked into the long grass. Their help goes on the back of Dungown Dam, which they took the money away from. Their help goes into such things as the road improvements to make things safer on the New England Highway, which they're putting under review. And now their help goes to, oh, we're going to keep the APV MMA in Armidale, but no one needs to work there. I can understand why people might vote for me. Got that. I might really annoy people. I've got that. But why on earth they vote for the Labor Party when all they ever do is turn up and treat you like an imbecile and then do you over has got me absolutely perplexed.
There is no denying, though, that there's been some pretty scathing reports of culture within the APVMA in Armidale. There's been some pretty awful reports of, you know, people urinating on colleagues at a Christmas party. I mean, obviously something has been not right within the APVMA.
A person who did the wrong thing who no longer works there. Now, let's use that rule in Canberra. Since that's the rule now for Armidale, and of course they said the culture's not right in Armidale, so they believe there's a whole city of barbarians or, there's some sort of genetic problem in Armidale and the whole city is somehow not worthy of a department. I mean, that in itself is an awfully big insult to everybody who lives in Armidale. And you've got to sort of listen to it and say to them, pull them up and go, hang on, what did you just say about us? I mean, what do you think? Do you think we're sort of a lesser type of being, you know, to the sunny uplands and the enlightenment of Canada? I mean, you know, go away. We can do this job just as well as you. And that's the rule, now let's go to Canberra and apply that rule. And every time there is an issue in any department, taxation department, Department of Social Security, Department of Defence, Parliament House itself, let's move it out. Because I tell you what, there seems to be a few issues going on around Parliament House lately, so are we moving that out of Canberra?
So what do you think is going to be key to bringing people to Armidale rather than Canberra? Or do you think the writing is on the wall that the headquarters, you know, won't be in Armidale for too long?
Well, the writing's on the wall when you have a party that treats you like an imbecile and then just looks after their mates who, like, every federal seat in Canberra is a Labor seat and one senator is Labor. So you know who they're going to look after, right? Now, the issue here is, do you believe in decentralising Australia? Do you believe in the wealth that comes from your listeners, from taxpayers, all being funneled into one city, Canberra, or do you believe that other areas have a right to some of that largesse as well and inspire the development of other areas? Remember, Canberra itself was just a sheep paddock on the Murrumbidgee and the Molongo Creek, right? So there was nothing there. The Southwells and I think the Campbell, who were pastoralists. And now you've got close to 400,000 people. Why? Because we said we'd move departments there, and that's how we built the city. And now the city doesn't need all the Commonwealth Government departments. It's doing very well on its own two feet. Now, at the time, no one wanted to move to Canberra. It was outrageous. You know, out in the sticks, who wants to move there? Now you can't get them to move out of there. So, you know, you've got to have a vision that lasts beyond your life. And I was trying to think that what we're doing for Armidale was really, in essence, what we should be doing across Australia.
Have you had a chance to speak to the Agriculture Minister, Murray Watt, about this, or will you be?
Listen to this. They give you a briefing on big decisions, but guess what? He wanted to give me a briefing. Now, generally, you'd think if you're going to give a briefing about a decision you're going to make, you would give the briefing beforehand. No. Once he saw I was doing media afterwards, actually in Armidale, then he said, we'll give you a briefing. What's the point, mate? You've just made your decision.
What will you be doing from here, though, to try and change the minister's mind to maybe see more staff employed in Armidale?
Well, that's what we do all the time. But, of course,
you see, you think you're up against sort of a rational, empathetic force when you talk to ministers such as Minister Watt, but you're not. You're up against, they're underwriting instructions from the Commonwealth Public Sector Union. They're underwriting instructions because it goes against the zeitgeist of Canberra. And what they give you is this sort of swindle spin, the same sort of swindle spin we've been getting with, you know, solar factories and transmission lines and swindle factories themselves, euphemistically called wind farms. I mean, don't you love that? They call them wind farms. No carrots, no peas, no spuds come from one of those. Just a big junkyard in 10 years' time. And then they think, ah, oh, these people are a little bit simple. And if we just run them this line, you know, and they're not interested in listening or changing. They're interested in doing what they believe they should do. And, you know, they have said it themselves. The culture of Armidale is wrong, that there is something sort of a little bit contemptible, something a little bit sort of banal and simple, sort of regional bucolic kitsch that all reside in a town and a city called Armidale. It's rather a large insult.
That's a member for New England, Barnaby Joyce, speaking there to Christy Reading. It's 21 minutes past 12.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Someone's texted in about, Dave's texted in asking why Bunnings, why they charge $12.98 for an Australian native pot plant when you can get the same one in a major discount store for $4.95. And another person's asked, why don't growers just put their produce through the markets rather than deal with the major retailers? Well, we had someone on that issue, Neil, and they said that once you do that, the price at the markets automatically plummet. Once you put the volume into the markets, the price of that produce automatically plummets because of the volume there. So that's the reason why they don't do that. It's coming up to 22 minutes past 12 here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Let's look at some floodplain harvesting issues now, because Greens MP and water spokesperson Kate Fairman says that the state government needs to act now to reform floodplain harvesting along the Northern Basin. The state government is yet to formalise a reform for floodplain harvesting despite amending regulations for environmental protections last year. Kate Fairman met recently with landholders along the Macquarie Marshes and spoke to Nick Lowther, saying that the floodplain harvesting, particularly the construction of dams, isn't contributing to healthy functioning ecosystems.
Landholders were talking to me about, you know, it doesn't really seem like anything in relation to floodplain harvesting in the Northern Basin has really shifted since the election of this current government. There's disappointment that there's still works being approved, and by works I mean, you know, reservoirs, floodplain harvesting storages are still being approved. It's quite extraordinary, really, to hear that. It just seems as though past practice is now being licensed, as we know. It's being legalised and nothing's really being done to reduce the extent that's being harvested.
When you talk about the works that people were talking about yesterday, those works, are they saying they're still within the constraints of the current laws, though?
Well, my understanding is that almost every second week there's a new application for approval of what has been unauthorised so far. So unauthorised storages, whether there's new reservoirs, I'm not sure. I chaired the inquiry into floodplain harvesting in the last parliament that the current, you know, the water minister now, Rose Jackson, sat on while she was in opposition. I think she expressed concerns at the time about these unauthorised works. And to hear that there seems to be very little chance for people to comment, there seems to be, in fact, other than those who are impacted downstream, there seems to be very little transparency around this as well. It's very hard to know exactly what's being approved. And to hear this is all happening under the new Labor government, who has expressed concern about this practice, is disappointing. I think people were wanting action sooner. They're worried in terms of when action is going to be taken. I understand that the minister is saying that a report that the connectivity panel has been, you know, looking into, has been working on for many months, is due out any day now, and that a lot will fall back on what that connectivity panel says. And by that I mean you know, what flow targets have to be met in certain at certain areas, including places like the Macquarie Marshes, before floodplain harvesting is allowed to go ahead.
The Macquarie Marshes themselves caught fire during the last drought. That's how dry the marshes were. In the current works between the Murray-Darling Basin Plan and the look at reforming floodplain harvesting, do landholders still hold the concern that it could turn out that dry again?
They absolutely do hold the concern that the marshes could dry out, obviously even more than what we saw last time. You know, things are just getting drier. We are having very big flood events as well as a result of climate change. But overall, the forecast, the predictions are drier periods with longer periods between when that water comes down. However, let's be very clear that it's the floodplain harvesting practices, though, that make drought conditions so much worse. And for the marshes not to have ongoing that water on a much more frequent basis, that's what, you know, that's where the environmental impacts really come in. That's how we're seeing the decline in bird numbers. Again, that has been very well documented. So there's climate change, there are droughts. We have to obviously look at what we can do to cope with a drying climate. But surely one of those things is ensuring that there is less water taken in the northern basin, that we rein in floodplain harvesting, that we get it back to within legal limits set out under the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. And that is certainly not what is going on right now, when in the order of hundreds of more gigalitres of water, of licences, have been handed out than what is legal under the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. So we haven't seen that reined in. We still don't, even with the change of government, we don't seem to have a water minister who is willing to do that. And so everybody's just watching now with interest and with impatience as to what action the government will take to get more water down the system.
Greens MP and water spokesperson Kate Fairman. Now, the Minister Rose Jackson was unavailable for an interview, but she sent a statement. She says, late last year, the New South Wales government announced changes to the licensing of floodplain harvesting to take a more measured and sustainable approach and reduce the risk of overallocation. The changes mean that floodplain harvesting shares in unregulated water sources will be reduced by up to 40% in the Namoi Valley, the last of the valleys in the Northern Basin to have floodplain harvesting licensing coming to effect. These amendments applied in the Namoi Valley resulted in up to 40% reduction of floodplain harvesting shares that were issued on that source. And she says the changes can be unsettling for communities during this period. They've met with Namoi Water to share their concerns and to hear their concerns and to work through solutions. These conversations have been constructive based on a shared understanding that the government's fundamental priority is to ensure water take is within legal limits. This adjustment will improve water management, the minister says, ultimately helping ensure we are striking the right balance between the needs of the environment, water users throughout the river system, and town water supply. Licensed, metered and monitored floodplain harvesting, the minister says, is critical for limiting extraction and ensuring that water take occurs within limits that are legally enforceable and sustainable. The New South Wales government has also established an independent connectivity expert panel to provide advice on potential rules that would improve flows for downstream connectivity. In fact, that report that they've just announced, that report, they've just released that report today. We're hoping to speak to some experts about that on the program tomorrow. And the minister finishes off by saying she's going to continue to listen to the concerns raised by the community, and she's taking a more precautionary approach to the licensing of floodplain harvesting in the remaining water sources. It's 28 past 12.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
With so much renewable energy being planned and built in regional New South Wales, what can landholders learn from someone who's been through the negotiating process? Tamworth farmer Richard Munsey has leased a third of his property for what will be the largest solar farm in Australia. He told David Claughton there's a second phase of construction for the New England solar farm, and while it's cut back his farm operation, the payments he and his neighbours are getting are significant.
The second part of the farm, stage two, construction for it, the roads into it will start shortly. Those contracts are out, and then it'll be another at least sort of year and a half construction until the last third of the whole solar farm will be complete.
And this will be the largest one in Australia, I'm told.
It will be the largest in Australia. There was another stage to it, but there was a little bit of rejection from some local farmers that are close to it. And when it came time to put it through the New South Wales government, they made the choice not to do that because they didn't want any hold-ups.
And what kind of a deal did you end up signing, and how were the payments structured?
Obviously, we can't talk figures, but it's a 30-year lease tied to CPI, or actually a little bit better than that.
They pay you an annual fee.
We're actually leasing our land to them.
And we're talking a figure that's, for each landholder, might be tens of thousands of dollars?
Oh, yeah.
Hundreds of thousands?
It could be.
And how much of your land is being taken up? Because you're telling me there's a few properties involved, you and your neighbours, so how much of your land would be taken up with these solar panels?
They've taken approximately a third of our 2,000 acres.
And what impact is that having on production, farm production?
We've probably cut our cattle numbers back by a third to a half.
That's a big cut, but you're being compensated handsomely, it sounds.
Yeah, look, the income that's been derived per hectare or acre is somewhere in the vicinity of 3 to 4 times what we can make, and that's every year. Because, you know, if we go into drought, well, then you know that we don't make a cent in that year.
So it helps to make you more resilient in those times.
Oh, look, there's enough income coming in that we wouldn't have to graze anything.
Mm. And what about third parties? Did you have to go through a broker or anything like that to cut this deal?
No, because there was a group of about 7 individual farms that are all, we're probably 5, 6, and 7 generation farmers, the whole lot of us. And so we've been neighbours for a long time and get on quite well. And we just all sat down together and took it on as a front so that the negotiations for the lease itself, which includes the price and how we were all to be treated, how it was worded, was all sat down and agreed upon by everybody together.
And it sounds like your background played quite nicely into this sort of situation. You've travelled quite a lot, worked quite a lot with infrastructure companies, yeah?
Well, that's right, yeah. I could see the benefits. If we didn't at least look at it and just have a look at the money and what it was going to do for us, somebody somewhere in our vicinity would have eventually taken up a solar farm contract. And then most likely because of our vicinity to the power line, we would have been looking at it over a fence instead of taking advantage of it.
And how do you look at the concerns around solar installations on farming land, good farming land sometimes? Is that something that you had to weigh up yourself?
Yes, but when you value land and it's true productiveness, ours is very low on the scale when you start comparing it to good cropping country out west, flood irrigation. Look, you're looking at tenfold the money involved out there that what you can produce here, because we have a very long cold winter. We have 2 to 3 months where we have very minimal growth, and that sort of limits a lot of your farming. A lot of this country is better wool production country than fattening.
And is anybody going to run sheep under the panels?
Out of the first stage, I think every farmer that's involved in it has got sheep under there, except one maybe.
And what about the end of the term? I mean, these are, as you say, multi-generational families. 30 years is going to go on a blink of an eyelid for some of them, really. What happens at the end with all those panels?
It's in their contract that they're to dismantle and put things back the way they were.
And what about your community? Obviously, there was some opposition to the project. Are the benefits spread at all in some way to the rest of the community there?
There is a community fund set up where anyone, whether it's a landholder or a soccer side or cricket club, anyone can put in to get some money from this fund that's set up. And it was something that they wanted to do, and they set it up so that it wasn't run by the council, and it was run by an independent group of locals, and they sat down on a board and they look at the people who ask for a bit of money, and then they decide on the merits of people who've put in for their grants.
Farmer Richard Munsey, who's leased some of his land to ASIN for the New England Solar Farm. It'll generate 720 megawatts of energy. That's enough to power 300,000 homes. The community grants he's mentioned include a future fund, which is getting $150,000 from the company a year, and a grants, sponsorship and donations fund of $150,000 a year that gets another $150,000 a year for at least the next few years. So, a bit of money floating around there as a result of that solar farm. It's coming up to 24 minutes to one. Time to get some news headlines now. From Adam Story, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. There's been a very solemn occasion at the Westfield Shopping Centre in Bondi today. The Premier and the Police Commissioner were the first of hundreds to walk through the shopping centre on what's being called a Day of Remembrance, which is an opportunity for members of the community to pay their respects. This is before trading resumes tomorrow, although, as we've already mentioned, that retailers won't be forced to open. It'll be up to the individual retailers if they choose to do so tomorrow. Meanwhile, the operators of Westfield Centre Group says they will waive rents for retail tenants. In a statement, it said rent at Bondi Westfield will be waived for the week from Saturday, April 13 to Friday, April 19. And it will continue to work with businesses to provide the support they need. Meanwhile, the police commissioner says detectives are working to identify up to 50 people who could potentially face charges over the riot in southwestern Sydney on Monday night. Police raided a home at Doonside yesterday and arrested a 19-year-old man in relation to the riot, which saw multiple officers injured and about 20 police cars trashed in the process. Slight uptick in the unemployment rate. It's up to 3.8%. That's below market expectations. 7,000 people lost work in March, but 21,000 started looking for it, which pushed the jobless rate up to 0.1%. Probably all those uni graduates that I just saw with their caps and their flowers walking out into the big world.
All decked out, that's right.
Mm. Now, speaking of uni students, the federal government's looking into changes to student debt. Each year, the loans or HECS debts rise on June 1 based on inflation, and modelling suggests this year indexation could be as high as 4.8%. So the Prime Minister says the government will soon be making announcements in response to recommendations from what's known as the Australian Universities Accord. And one story that's grabbed my attention, a man has been charged with driving 110 kilometres above the speed limit on Mount Panorama. A 22-year-old clocked him at 170 kilometres an hour. Now, if it's not race day, Concord Strait's only a 60 zone, apparently.
Right. Okay, yeah. Well, there you go.
So I actually thought it'd be a bit faster. But, yeah, so.
It's pretty long and it's pretty straight.
It's pretty long, pretty straight. Mm. Yeah.
Depends on where it is, I suppose.
Yeah, 170. Yeah.
170. Probably not
so,
a great idea.
He's been issued with a court attendance notice, no doubt.
That's right. And he would imagine he's going to lose his licence. All right. Thanks for that.
Ciao.
And you'll be back at 1 o'clock?
Yes.
Okay, we'll be listening. It's coming up to 21 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Let's find out what's happening with the weather details. Dylan Bird at the Bureau, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael. How are you?
Good, good. So we had a bit of wild weather around and some thunderstorm activity yesterday. Has that all sort of moved through now?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of it has, but at the same time, it looks like we're having another wave, though, just for today, for some severe thunderstorm risks through much of the northeast, including parts of the Hunter, and that will be for, if any severe storms do occur, for damaging wind gusts, potential for hail, and localized heavy rainfall. There's even a chance that we might get some giant hailstones, so that's greater than 5 centimeters in diameter, near the southern parts of the northern ranges in the afternoon. But in saying that, there are currently storms through the northwest slopes and plains at the moment in that part of the world, and it looks like the storm activity will keep building in that part of the world during the afternoon and then shift a bit further east and northeast over the next coming hours, easing off by the early to mid part of the evening.
But it is a bit hit and miss.
Yeah, hit and miss. So in terms of actual rainfall, though, I mean, on the forecast, really it's just looking at broadly over the northeast, somewhere between maybe 5 and 15 mils. But in a thunderstorm, you might see somewhere between maybe 20 to 40 mils plus.
Okay, so looking further ahead, what can we expect?
Yeah, so generally speaking, it looks like over Friday, we've got a bit of a southerly surge as a trough moves through Victoria into New South Wales, and we get a bit of like it's a southwesterly to southerly change, a bit fresh along the coast, coastal showers through much of New South Wales, and then into the southwest slopes as well, but fairly dry in the west. We might get a bit of a cloud band with like 1 or 2 millimetres for southern, western and central western districts. But then on Saturday, an upper feature moves through the northeast, and we might see another round of thunderstorm activity, but it doesn't look to be severe at this point. And a bit cool over Friday, Saturday and Sunday, with shower activity really just over the north, like the northern coastal parts and northern ranges by Sunday, and then easing trend Monday onwards with a few showers lingering in the northeast.
And what about the inland?
Yeah, inland, unfortunately, on the forecast for the next 7 days, completely dry apart from the northern inland today.
Right,
so elsewhere looks like west and south, southern parts are getting really no reprieve at all, and then, yeah, through northern parts from Sunday onwards looking very dry.
Okay, so dry and sunny, but not particularly warm.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, cool change. Might even see a frost or two, maybe some fog forming over the southeast ranges and into the Monaro country down there too. But that's coming Sunday and Monday morning.
All right, Dylan, thanks for that.
No worries. Cheers, Michael.
It's coming up to 18 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Now, New South Wales authorities are investigating the discovery of hundreds of butchered horses at an alleged illegal knackery in the state's south. Wagga Wagga City Council said it was leading the investigation with New South Wales Police and other agencies after reports that horse carcasses had been dumped around a dry creek bed near Wagga Wagga. It said more than 500 horses appeared to have been slaughtered. That's over a fairly long period of time. Our reporter Lucas Forbes has been following the story and joins us now. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So what's actually been alleged here?
Well, what's been alleged, Wagga Council has alleged that a month ago they made a visit to a property with about 12 to 15 people in total with from various agencies to investigate a property, and they found what they say was about 500 or so carcasses strewn throughout this property, about, I think, 200 in one particular pile, you know, what they described as a dry creek bed, but there are also separate piles throughout the property. So they said that these investigations are currently still ongoing. They describe this as being an alleged illegal knackery, but they've just said that the investigations from council are still ongoing, and police have said that to us that they're waiting to hear back from council on what to do next as well.
But even for for an illegal knackery, that is a huge number of horses we're talking about here.
It's an extraordinary amount of horses. It's I think we've been trying to think of different ways to imagine what 500 horses would actually look like. I think at one point someone kind of said that it would be like the size of our office building at the very least. Mm. It's a very hard figure to wrap one's head around.
Absolutely. So what's been the reaction to this? Pretty amazed, the reaction, I gather.
Well, I mean, yes, I think being amazed and
shocked
would be another word we could definitely use there. A lot of people have said that this is, a lot of people we've spoken to have said that this is simply something completely out of left field, this sort of the scale of the allegations at this point. We spoke with two councillors in particular, Mick Henderson and Richard Foley, who were very surprised and very shocked that this had happened. Councillor Henderson even went as far as to say that this is just the sort of thing that doesn't really happen around here. Mm. The local member, Joe McGurr, is that once whatever investigations by the police and the council are complete, he says he would like to see a state inquiry to find out more about what exactly has happened.
And I gather that this property also was home to some Brumbies as well as some thoroughbreds, so a whole range of horses we're talking about here. Do we know how this came to light? Was it an anonymous tip, or was it a tip-off, or did someone drive past and notice? Well, do we know how it came to the council's attention?
Well, yes, we know that there's been there was about 2 months ago, we know that there was an anonymous tip-off that someone had noticed these bodies and had made the complaint to council. From there, about a month ago, they then made that visit, that investigation, to see if they could ascertain exactly what was happening. I think the trigger point was the allegation that this had been in a dry creek bed, which triggered potential offences under the Protection of the Environment Operations Act. But from there, we know that on Monday, there was a secret briefing to the local councillors here, which was then subsequently leaked to the media. And then from there, it all came out, and council felt that it had to say something, which is how we ended up getting onto the story as well.
Mm. Now, no charges have been laid. New South Wales Police and Council, Wagga Wagga City Council, are investigating the matter. But you also spoke to Adrian Talbot, the man at the centre of these allegations of the illegal knackery. Let's have a listen to what he had to say.
What happened was, so going back, this all happened about 6 weeks ago. I had a number of authorities come onto the premises, EPA, RSPCA, Rural Crime Squad, BioSafe, Council, all inspected the property on the day.
What exactly, I mean, they allege that there were, that it's an illegal knackery.
Yeah.
Can you just tell me how many horse bodies are on your property?
Yeah, so they came out to inspect alleged 30 or 40, which would be closer to the number. For Bill Thompson to say 500, it was blown way out of proportion, way, way out. Same guy that said, I've put them up a creek, which now he says, you know, dry creek. Creek's never had water in it. Creek's never had running water in it. Is it still a creek? No, it's not. It's a hole that we dug to build the levee bank up. However, since I've had it removed and disposed of properly, I've abide by all the rules and regulations. The authorities have been back, ticked me off. There's been no charges. There was no talk of any charges or any wrongdoing.
Although council did say yesterday that they were still investigating what regulatory action they may take. So is there...
The council, yeah, he says... there's still ongoing investigations. I don't know. I've been ticked off everything as far as I'm aware of. I don't know what the council's up to there.
So just to clarify, you're saying that there wasn't 500 horses. There
Absolutely
was
not.
More like 40 or so.
Yep.
Why would... I mean, how would anyone get that wrong? That's more than a factor of 10.
Yeah.
How would anybody...
Know. That's just mind-boggling.
Why are these horses
here
in the first place?
Yeah, because I've been buying horses 20 years. And when horse sales are on, I take horses, the different horse sales. You know, people bring a lot of horses to home as far as, you know, especially like on the racing side of things, like I've been placed on an excluded list because there's nowhere for people, for owners, strappers, trainers to send their thoroughbreds. There's that many rules and regulations in place, they just can't do anything with them. There's paddock fulls of them sitting around everywhere. Get neglected because they can't. There's nowhere for them to go.
Why? So how did these? How did these horses die?
So they were euthanized humanely by a licensed shooter for my own purpose or my own pet food.
So not by yourself.
Not by myself, no.
And so you've been processing these 40 horses. They were all used for your own personal pet food.
Own personal use over the last 3 years.
How many animals do you have that this
feeds? Oh, probably 10 dogs there.
People would say like one horse could feed several dogs for months.
Probably depends on the size of the dog.
So how... you also told me over the phone that you have a role as a halfway house,
yep.
Sort of like a halfway house for rehoming. For people who aren't familiar, can you tell us?
Essentially, you could say that. So I become involved in the Brumby side of things. So rules and regulations with the Brumbies through the national parks is that their guidelines, you need a slam shut gate, take a minimum of 5 horses, has to be 1800 high. Not everyone has the means of transport for a wild horse, and not everyone wants to take 5 horses at once. So I'd drive up there, take the truck up with the facilities at home. I can load 1 horse, I can load 2 horses, I can load 10 horses. So people would come, phone up and take horses, or I'd deliver them. There's been a large number of Brummie rescue mobs who I've worked with for non-profit, dropped horses off, that have reached out, individuals as well, and said, hey, you've done a great job. We appreciate the job you've done. If you need any support, we've got your back.
I mean, were any of those horses, these Brumbies, were they among the ones that were euthanised?
There was which national parks are well aware of, because you have to state where they go and what the destination of them is. There was a handful of older horses. There was one that had one eye that needed veterinary attention that probably shouldn't have been. These were horses that were sent down to me. I never collected them. That probably shouldn't have been transported. Probably should have been euthanised through the park sort of things. And a couple of the other horses that, you know, for instance, may have stepped in one bat hole, broke a leg and have healed pretty bent. They probably shouldn't have been sent down either.
What did, curious, because you, the council, when the council and others visited your property, and they counted up they came up with the estimate of roughly 500 horses.
Yeah.
I mean, did you protest at the time? What did they, like, what was...
They didn't give me an actual figure on the day. They didn't, they came to the house, they left the house, conducted their investigations and left, didn't kind of see me on the way out. So there was no talk of a number on the day they left. And I haven't had any contact with Peter Thompson since.
So the first you heard about the 500 horses allegation was...
yesterday.
When it hit the media.
Yes.
That's Lucas Forbes talking to Adrian Talbot. That's the man who's the centre of those allegations of an illegal knackery, and he's putting his side of the story there. You're listening to The Country Hour. As I said, still being investigated by the police and also the Wagga Wagga City Council. It's 8 minutes to 1 here on The Country Hour. Let's look at some of the texts, because there's quite a few that have come through on the floodplain harvesting issue. Someone's texted through saying there is quite a few minor to moderate floods in southern Queensland heading into the northern New South Wales basin. What has happened to these flows? Have they made it into the Darling, etc.? We need to follow up on that to get you an answer for that one. Someone else is saying that the Greens MP is not correct. Because the licensing volumes for floodplain harvesting, they're a third of what they were permitted before the government licensed that take, and it's that's within the legal limits there. So they're saying they're taking issue what the Greens MP was saying about the amount that's allowed to be taken. Also, someone else has texted in saying that looks like the public servants have been running water in New South Wales over the past decade on a business-as-usual plan surrounding and stifling Rose Jackson's attempts at change to the better. And someone's texted in to take issue with the Concord Strait story about saying how many laps does a person have to do 170 kilometres. I think the issue was that the person was allegedly clocked to doing 170 kilometres an hour in that 60 zone. So taking issue with the way that that was expressed there was Peter. Just, wanting to get the facts right, no doubt. And, there's a whole range of stories, a whole range of texts coming through about some of the other stories as well. Some of those about the horse knackery story probably can't broadcast them. It's coming up to 6 minutes to 1 on The Country Hour.
Hello, I'm Sally Sara. Join me for The World Today. Bondi Junction Shopping Centre opens its doors for the first time after a mass stabbing attack on the weekend. Residents and staff gather to remember the victims. Are consumers being ripped off by complicated electricity pricing? And plans to cull more crocodiles in northern Australia? But the mother of a young girl killed by a croc calls for calm. Those stories and much more coming up this lunchtime on The World Today.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour.
On ABC Radio New South Wales.
It's coming up to 5 minutes to one, and that's time to go to markets. First up to Wagga Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. 40,000 lambs and 16,000 sheep sold to a smaller group of buyers. However, on the domestic front, major domestic processors were operating keenly. Quality was on the plainer side and buyers had to step up for the neater, prettier type lambs. The market was firm to a few dollars dearer in places. 18 to 24 kilo, 115 to 168. 24 to 26, 158 to 174. 26 to 30, 170 to 196. Over 30 kilos, 194 to 243. Light lambs to the processors slipped back $20 to $40. While store lambs back to the paddock sold at $60 to $115. And lambs to feed on made from $115 to $135. With the sheep yet to be sold, I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Let's go to Dubbo Cattle. The details there. Here's Graham Richard.
Good afternoon. The numbers were back to 3,800. The quality was fair to good. Noticeably, there weren't as many heavy cattle through the yarding. There was a good number of medium weight feeders and only a limited supply of good trade cattle. Grown steers and heifers were back in volume and there was a plainer run of cows. The feeder steers were firm to 6 cents cheaper with only the crossbreds bringing the average back. Medium weights 305 to 360. Heavy feeders 300 to 355. Feeder heifers are 12 to 15 cents stronger, 240 to 310, averaging 295. Heavy trade cattle are 10 to 15 stronger, the steers 300 to 336, heifers 280 to 319. Prime grown steers are back 10, 280 to 308, the heifers are 25 cents softer, reaching 250 to process. Cows are back 25 to 35 cents, heavy 3 and 4 scores 205 to 232, the medium weight 2 scores 148 to 215. And this has been Graham Richard.
Let's go to Yass Cattle now, and here's David Kent.
Good afternoon, Michael. Numbers continue to increase, lifting by 780 for a total yarding of 1,858 mixed quality cattle. There were several lines of outstanding grown steers reaching 327, along with some good pens of yearling steers attracting keen competition from both feedlot buyers and the restocker orders. Well-finished yearlings to suit the trade were limited, and there were 580 mostly plainer quality cows. All the usual buyers were operating, selling to a softer market. Trade yearling steers down 10. 280 to 324, heifers to process 240 to 290, feeder steers back 15, 250 to 342, heifers to feed slip 20 to average 262. Well finished heavy cattle, a few cents easier, steers 212 to 327, heifers 190 to 300, leaner cows at least 50 cents cheaper, 120 to 204, heavy prime cows decline 30, 174 to 236 cents per kilo. This is David Kent at SELX Yass for MLA.
And let's go to Armidale Cattle now and James Armitage.
Good afternoon. A few positive trends, but mostly negatives in a yarding of 1,030 head. Heavy feeders and steers and cows had the best representation in a mixed quality penning. Increased feedlot and restocker competition with the same processes in attendance. Weaner steers to restockers cheaper, 260 to 353 cents. The lighter end of the heifers following suit, 186 to 259. Heavier weights to 276 were firm to dearer. Heavyweight yearling feeder steers saw a little bit quality related price change. 310 to 342. Light and medium weight yearling heifers cheaper, 208 to 280 cents. Heavyweights a shade dearer, 270 to 278. Heavy grown steers fell away, 256 to 275. Cows substantially cheaper than the fortnight ago. Medium weight 2 and 3 scores 130 to 198, with the heavy 3 and 4 scores 160 to 217 cents a kilo. James Armitage for MLA in Armidale.
And that's the market information for today. Still a couple of texts coming through. Mick says, in his opinion, Barnaby's discussion there turned into a bit of a speech, but it was his view that it was Barnaby making it look as though he wasn't accountable for all the mistakes that were made in the move of that government department, the APVMA, to Armidale. And also on the horse issue, and this is just a general issue about the race industry. Someone's texted in saying the multi-million dollar race industry breed thousands of horses that don't race, or they race once or twice, and then they're useless unless they can move or jump or move well for dressage, and then that's only a few. So the rest of them, this person's saying, is off with their heads. to feed the greyhounds. You're listening to the Country Hour. We're heading up to news time at 1 o'clock.